It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Much of Wisconsin is experiencing hazardous air quality this week as wildfire smoke from Canada and Minnesota blows across the state.
Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources issued an air quality advisory with conditions ranging from unhealthy for sensitive groups to very unhealthy or hazardous in some areas.
The smoke hit earliest and hardest in northern Wisconsin, where residents like Brenda Bodine of Superior said even a short time outside caused her eyes to burn and irritated her throat.
I don't remember it ever being like this. Last year or the year before, I don't believe it was this bad. You could smell it, but it didn't block out the sun.
We're getting a better sense now of how this wildfire smoke is impacting Wisconsin and what to expect from the reduced air quality. Danielle Kading is a reporter covering the environment in northern Wisconsin for WPR's Superior Bureau. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, you in Superior got it first and worst, it looks like, as I watch the air quality maps. Paint us a picture of life in Superior right now amid all this smoke.
Yeah, you know, first we were dealing with the extreme heat, and then yesterday morning I could smell the smoke before I even stepped outside. And it's like when you sit next to a bonfire and you can still smell it on your hair and your clothes. That's what it's like right now. Like the sky was so thick with smoke yesterday that you couldn't see across the harbor. And I was out there this morning. I could see a little bit of blue sky, but I still really couldn't see the Duluth Lift Bridge. It's just like a faint outline of it. You can't see across the harbor to Superior. And so, you know, like there's just a lot of shifting from gray to yellow to orange, and one resident even said you could taste the smoke in the air. So yeah, it's not ideal out there.
And as I'm watching the numbers, I mean, compared to even the worst of the Canadian wildfire smoke a couple of years ago, your numbers are higher than I had seen here. 500s, 1,000 I'm seeing by Lake Superior. I mean, are people taking precautions here? Are you seeing people change the way they live their lives?
You know, I really haven't seen too much of that. I have seen people around wearing masks, but there's also a lot of people outside who are like mowing their lawns, they're riding bikes, they're walking around. I talked to one guy yesterday who's working on his friend's deck. You know, there's kind of an attitude among some that this is temporary and you can't stop living.
What kind of health concerns are medical professionals worried about from this kind of smoke?
Well, you know, wildfire smoke can cause respiratory issues like shortness of breath, coughing, and inflammation of the lungs that worsens asthma or emphysema or COPD. But it also increases the risk of heart disease or heart attacks because these tiny particles in the wildfire smoke can get into the bloodstream. And I think Clean Wisconsin put out an analysis yesterday that estimated this smoke can cause 250 premature deaths each year in Wisconsin.
And where is all this smoke coming from? Where is the range of fires that we're inhaling right now in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think, you know, for us up here, a lot of it is coming from northern Minnesota and Canada as well. But, you know, the last I had seen, there were 15 fires and 4 in the boundary waters that were actively burning. And those numbers are changing daily. I think they had said at last count around 55,000 acres had burned so far in northern Minnesota, and officials were saying some of that would burn until it snows. And in Canada, you know, there's more than 800.
Until it snows? This is July.
Yeah, until it snows. Yeah, I mean, because these are really remote areas, yeah, and it's hard to get into. And so they're going to be protecting life and property. But, you know, if it's remote and there's no risk, I think that the approach right now is to let that burn out. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of fires in Canada right now, a lot of acreage burned. I think it was roughly 6 million acres. And it's just expanded a lot in the last week because of these hot, dry, windy conditions.
And finally, Danny, as a reporter and a local resident there, I'm sure you're watching for when this is going to lift. Any signs that this is going to go away for you anytime soon?
Well, I am eager to hear what Craig has to say about that. You know, I was seeing from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that they're expecting it at least through Friday to be pretty bad up here. And, you know, still like two, three times what's considered hazardous up here. So it's, for now, there's no relief in the immediate future.
Danny, thanks and stay safe.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter covering the environment in northern Wisconsin for our Superior Bureau at WPR, with us to share her reporting on the wildfire smoke in Wisconsin. We're checking in on how long this pollution could stick around and what residents can do to limit the impact. Craig Czarnecki is Air Management Outreach Coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Craig, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
We've had wildfire smoke years in the past. Craig, how does the severity of this smoke compare?
We're definitely seeing more significant impacts with this wildfire smoke episode compared to previous years. In fact, I will just start by letting everyone know we are going to be extending the advisory through noon tomorrow. So that's statewide. And then at which point we'll reassess again tomorrow morning. So we'll see, what's going to happen. There's a chance that we'd have to extend again for parts of eastern Wisconsin and then maybe along the Lake Superior shoreline as well. But for now, we are extending that advisory until noon Friday, and then we'll revisit and see where we're at there. But the levels we're seeing, I know statewide, widespread, very unhealthy to that hazardous level on the air quality index scale. Those are, some of the highest levels that we've recorded. And then, the reason being, these fires are in close proximity, especially to northwest Wisconsin there that got hit particularly hard yesterday and is having more effects today. But really, the significant smoke impacts, the proximity for us is the big one. Beyond that, weather conditions such as the wind, our temperatures, and the low humidity, that contributes to fire behavior, smoke accumulation as well. Winds bring a fresh supply of oxygen to the fire, and that's able to push the fire into new fuels. And then we've just had, really, really hot weather. We've had dry winds. So you combine all that, and that causes wildfires to grow very rapidly. And that's exactly what we saw happen over the last 10 days or so in northern Minnesota.
Right, that proximity. In years past, when we've had smoke in Wisconsin, it was from far western Canada. The smoke went way up and then came back down on us here. And I thought, okay, well, this smoke, it's nearby. It'll go way up and come down further east. Well, Rob was really wrong. And that proximity, is that what's leading to these much higher concentrations of particulates that we're worried about?
Yeah, the proximity is definitely the big one for us. Just these fires are closer than typically, than we've seen the last few years. Like you said, Western Canada, in 2023, we had some way out in Quebec. So that smoke had to travel a lot farther to get here. But then just so on top of the proximity, then just, you put all these like perfect conditions for extreme fire growth, and that just created a massive amount of smoke as well. So kind of a 1-2 punch there.
We heard from Danny in Superior, which has taken a lot of the worst of this. A lot of people out and about living their daily lives like normal. In your department at the DNR, are you recommending we change our behavior if we're in, especially in these hazardous areas?
Yeah, certainly. We're definitely recommending if you're in that hazardous, you want to be avoiding all outdoor physical activity. Stay indoors, if you can, especially if you're in one of those sensitive groups, if you're, children, the elderly, anyone with any kind of asthma, bronchitis, any kind of respiratory, heart, or lung diseases, you really, really want to be staying indoors during this event. And then even healthy people, stay indoors, avoid outdoor physical activity during this episode is really what we're trying to encourage here.
This is, of course, school summer program season, lots of outdoor programs. Are you making recommendations to people holding outdoor events, especially ones that involve kids?
Yeah, certainly. And a great example, I have two kids in a summer program here in Madison. They were supposed to go to the Milwaukee Zoo today for a
Wow.
field trip. That got canceled, which was obviously the right decision there. So they'll be spending time indoors today. So DNR, we communicate with the Department of Public Instruction and the Department of Health, letting them know, when these events and episodes are coming. This one is, quite extreme. So we wanted to give people enough time to kind of plan around this and make alternative options, definitely, to be avoiding the outdoors here.
What is the best way for people to watch for air quality conditions in their local area to know if they're in that hazardous zone?
Yeah, so there's a couple of good resources online. We have our air quality web map on our website, although it's been so busy the last day or two, it's running a little slower than we like, so we're working on getting that fixed right now. But then the EPA has a fire and smoke map that's also a great resource people can check out. That has all of our regulatory monitor locations and levels on it, and then also people who have low-cost sensors can include their data on that network as well. So it really helps fill in a lot of the spatial gaps there. So the EPA fire and smoke map, and then the DNR's air quality map are two good places to check there.
Now, you broke the news. You've extended the warning until tomorrow at noon, at which time you'll reevaluate what goes into that decision tomorrow at noon to say, okay, we're done, or we extend this.
Yeah, that's a great question. So kind of what we're looking at right now, we do expect to see some clearing of smoke kind of from west to east throughout the day tomorrow as some southerly winds pick up. So it's going to depend on how strong those winds get and just how much clearing is actually able to take place. And like I said, it will be possible we'll have to extend the advisory for eastern Wisconsin, especially places along the Lake Michigan shoreline. And then also places along Lake Superior as well, as the lake effect, just like it can affect, weather, it can also affect concentrations of smoke, kind of trap those near the shorelines. So we'll be looking at, how the wind cleans things up for us tomorrow, and then kind of where things are still settled and where we might need to extend that advisory yet.
Well, I'll let you get back to it, Craig. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for the time and having me on this morning.
That's Craig Czarnecki, Air Management Outreach Coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, with us today to share the latest on wildfire smoke polluting air around the state. Earlier, we heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading in Superior about how that area has experienced some of the worst air quality conditions. Share your stories, your pictures. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, a new report says the number of people in Wisconsin state prisons serving sentences for drunken driving is soaring, and treatment alternatives are limited.
Only half of Wisconsin counties have what we call drunk driving courts, which are treatment courts.
Reaction from a criminal defense attorney, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year, a private college in northern Wisconsin closed its doors due to financial challenges. By the time Northland College in Ashland closed, it had borrowed $22 million from its endowment to fund operations.
Now, a judge is set to sign off on the college's plan to dole out what little money remains. As Daniel Kading reports, some donors say the college violated their trusts and potentially the law.
Brett Norgaard remembers his son Bjorn as a kind and adventurous kid. While attending Northland College in Ashland, his son volunteered for a local nonprofit group shoveling snow and mowing lawns for seniors. But in 2011, a teenage driver killed the 23-year-old in a hit-and-run crash. After his son's death, Norgaard received a letter from the family of one elderly couple about the time they shared with Bjorn.
The husband had had a stroke and he was not able to speak, but he was alert. And Bjorn would sit down with him and talk about hunting and stuff. And
family and friends created a scholarship fund at Northland in Bjorn's name, along with a second fund that provided financial support to students for various activities. Over the years, Norgaard says they donated at least $156,000 between the two endowed funds. But now, most of the money is gone.
We threw everything into these two scholarships in terms of keeping his memory alive. So it's like a gut punch.
Cars roll by on a busy state highway as I'm standing in front of Northland College in Ashland. Earlier this year, the Northland Board of Trustees revealed it had borrowed $22 million from its restricted endowment to fund operations. It asked the court to release restrictions and approve its plan for doling out roughly $3 million that remained. In a recent hearing, an Iron County judge found the board complied with state law on repurposing funds in line with donor wishes. That law is known as the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. But Norgard says the college didn't follow the family's intent under the law, which oversees how institutions manage endowment funds. Northland Board Chair Ted Bristol said the college tried to balance the interests of all involved. In 2024, former Northland president Chad Dayton told WPR that declining enrollment and increasing costs forced the college to borrow from its endowment.
Northland is no longer in a position to rely upon its endowment to cover operational expenses.
Northland's attorney, Courtney Schultz, told the court that the law allowed the college to loan itself money from pooled endowment funds, and it borrowed from restricted funds between 2012 and 2019. Ben Orzeski is chief counsel for the Uniform Law Commission. He says the law doesn't say an institution can't loan itself money.
But it would be difficult to structure a type of loan to an institution that would be deemed prudent under the law.
Susan Gary is a retired professor with the University of Oregon School of Law who drafted changes to the law in the early 2000s. She says the attorney general would have the right to review whether violations occurred, but oversight is often limited.
They, of course, have limited resources to investigate things. And so the problem now is, yes, there may have been a violation, but that doesn't really help the fact that the money is gone.
The Wisconsin Department of Justice didn't comment about its review of Northland's funds and the college's request to release restrictions on them. Assistant Attorney General Michael Morris has said he found no clear violations of the law. Rocky Barker with the nonprofit Sigurd Olsen Environmental Institute says it's set to receive around $900,000 of remaining funds. Barker says he trusts the review conducted by the Attorney General's office.
They thought that Northland was handling this legally and properly.
But Norgard and representatives of the nonprofit Meadwitter Foundation say irregularities in Northland's financial reporting and management of funds suggest the college violated the law. Norgard wants the Attorney General's office to take another look.
I'm optimistic that if the truth comes out, that justice will, you know, somehow prevail.
Norgard and Meadwitter fear the case will have a chilling effect on anyone who donates to endowed funds, and students will suffer most. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News. The number of people in Wisconsin state prisons serving sentences for drunken driving is soaring. That's according to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
The researchers found that the number of convictions for operating while intoxicated, or OWI, has more than quadrupled since 2000, hitting a record high of nearly 2,900 people behind bars in 2024.
The report says that harsher penalties have led to that rise, and even though alcohol consumption is declining overall, people who use alcohol frequently are drinking significantly more than before.
In just a bit, we'll get reaction to these findings from a criminal defense attorney in Milwaukee. But first, for a look at the report, we have Joe Pietrangelo, research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum and an author on the report titled Impairment to Imprisonment. Joe, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Your data reveals that a growing number of people are going to prison for operating while intoxicated in Wisconsin. How could an OWI conviction lead to a prison sentence in the state?
Well, so Wisconsin has policies for each OWI offense, operating while intoxicated offense. So a first offense is treated as a civil infraction, so it's not a criminal charge. And so people with a first OWI offense typically do not spend time in jail or prison. But as people have more than one offense, and especially as you get to a fourth offense or higher, your chances of going to prison are much higher. Wisconsin has made the penalties harsher for fourth and subsequent OWIs in recent years. So that is leading to people spending longer periods of time in prison.
And your report, it outlines a couple possible reasons for the increase of people in prison for OWI. So you mentioned there some stricter laws and an increase in drinking alcohol. How can you walk us through how you came to these conclusions that these are the potential causes?
We can't really measure the impact of specific changes to the increase in incarceration, but we interviewed a number of people across systems, Department of Corrections, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Justice, to get perspectives on what's happening throughout the system. And we also talk with public health experts to really understand the drinking behavior in the state. And that's where the combination of talking to all these different individuals, we gather that some of the key factors were the policy changes, as well as certain individuals drinking more and driving while intoxicated more than they were in the past.
Okay, then moving on to the policy side and the movement you see there, you know, fourth offense OWI and higher among the strictest penalties in the nation here in Wisconsin. How have laws changed?
So what we did is we compared the penalties for each OWI offense between Wisconsin and all of the neighboring states, so the five states that surround Wisconsin. And so that's where we found, as I mentioned, Wisconsin, for a first OWI offense, it's a civil infraction. It's not a criminal charge. Wisconsin is the only state that treats a first OWI offense like that in the region. So in all of the other five states that surround us, a first OWI is a criminal misdemeanor. And so often a person may serve some time in a local jail, for example. In Wisconsin, that's not the case. But as you go up to a second, third, fourth, especially a fourth and subsequent offense, Wisconsin has tightened those laws in a number of ways. There have been several policy changes that have extended fourth and subsequent offenses, and also those that involve aggravating factors, such as if a youth was in the vehicle, if somebody was injured or killed in the crash. So there were several policy changes that have extended those penalties. And that's where, when we compare Wisconsin with those neighboring states on fourth and subsequent offenses, Wisconsin and Illinois have the toughest penalties in terms of longer typical sentences than the other states.
The increase in prison sentences, it's affecting some specific populations. Can you talk about the people who are more frequently incarcerated for OWI?
Yes, we saw several trends that were troubling in the data on incarceration. First of all, older adults are much more likely to be incarcerated for an OWI than they were in the past. We found that the OWI incarceration rate for adults 55 and over has more than tripled since 2010. Mm-hmm. So that was a significant increase. We also see more women incarcerated for OWIs than in the past. However, women are still a small minority of those incarcerated for OWI. Back in 2000, they accounted for less than 7%. In 2025, they were more than 11% of the total. So it's a slow but steady increase. So it is a concern. And then we also see significant racial disparities among those who are incarcerated for OWI. The American Indian population has the highest incarceration rate for OWIs. That's been a longer term trend. But we also found that whereas the Black incarceration rate was very similar to the white incarceration rate in the past, it has now grown quite a bit, the Black incarceration rate for OWI, where it is now about double the rate for the white population.
Mm. You offer some solutions, like expanding access to substance abuse programs, some alternatives. One involves taxation, about the state's beer tax. Why might raising that tax help lower the incarceration rate?
So again, the public health experts we consulted with really suggested that or pointed to evidence that the cost of alcohol can have a significant impact on the drinking behavior. And so Wisconsin, we found, has it taxes beer at $2 per 31-gallon barrel, and that has been the same since 1977. So that's one alcohol tax. There are separate taxes on wine and liquor. So there is quite a bit of evidence that, making alcohol more costly, also reducing access in other ways, such as by limiting the hours during which alcohol can be purchased. Those are strategies that can reduce excess alcohol consumption.
Joe, thank you for sharing this report with us.
Thank you for having me.
Joe Pietrangelo is research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum and an author of a new report that looks into OWI incarceration in the state. To look further at OWI cases and their impact, we have Deja Vishny, a criminal defense attorney in Milwaukee. She served as an adjunct professor at Marquette University Law School for 20 years. Deja, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, and thanks for having me on.
What strikes you about this report and the increase in people incarcerated for operating while intoxicated?
Well, there were two things I thought about. And what jumped to mind first and foremost is that Wisconsin has, generally speaking, a really high incarceration rate. And the nationwide trend of mass incarceration is particularly aggravated in the state of Wisconsin. So when I looked at this, the fact that there were more people in prison for DUI in the state of Wisconsin than in other states was not surprising to me. The second thing that really stood out to me was what I might call disproportionate minority confinement. In other words, the report shows that Native Americans and Black Americans are incarcerated at the highest rate in Wisconsin, at a higher rate than white people. Native Americans are incarcerated at a rate four times higher than whites and twice as high as Black people, who in turn are incarcerated at twice the rate of white people. That is consistent with incarceration in general in the state of Wisconsin, and it's an enormous problem.
You've talked about the cost of incarceration for society. What do you view as the cost burden of prison sentences for OWI convictions?
One of the reasons to be concerned about mass incarceration is it is not effective for public safety. Most of the problems with mass incarceration have to do with the length of sentences, because the longer sentences and the more people spending more time in longer sentences in prison raises the prison population. When you have repeat DUI offenders, it's clearly not having an impact. You know, most people who get a DUI, I think, stop after their first one. They take an Uber, they quit driving, they're compliant with the law. Maybe some of them get two, but once you start to get more and more people getting DUIs, there doesn't seem to be a real deterrent effect. And our society, or I would say prosecutors and judges, are very heavily focused on the aspect of sentencing that's called punishment. We want to punish these people. What I think is a more effective route to curbing DUI and repeat DUI offenders is to look at public safety. What can be done to enhance public safety in DUIs apparently isn't working with a certain population who keep getting repeated DUIs.
In terms of this public safety, and we can talk about alternatives to incarceration, but when you look at these Department of Transportation statistics, in 2024, 163 people are killed, 3,500 people injured due to intoxicated driving crashes. How can policymakers balance the needs of the offender, but also the potential victims here?
Well, I think obviously policymakers are going to be interested in they should be interested, and hopefully they are, in preserving life and reducing DUI. So there are solutions that are mentioned in the report. Higher alcohol taxes seems to be one solution. Reduction of the number of alcohol licenses. But one of the things that really stood out to me, well, there were a couple of things. One was that only half of Wisconsin counties, or about half, have drug, or what we call drunk driving courts, which are treatment courts. According to the report, there's 38 of those statewide, but we have 72 counties. So that means in half the counties, we aren't seeing a treatment alternative. The other thing the report suggests is more in prison substance abuse programs, and I would also say more in jails, because jails are not very resourced. That's where you're going to have your earlier DUI, you know, the second and thirds. They're spending their time in jail, not in prison. And if they don't have treatment resources, but it's just a holding cell, it's not really doing very much to try to address their problems. Another issue is alternative transportation. And when you live in a larger city, there are more alternatives. There's public transportation, and there's probably a greater number of either taxis or rideshare applications that you could have on your phone. So that seems to be helpful. The one thing where is not a helpful suggesting is reducing the acceptable BAC to 0.5, because the data shows 67% of fatal accidents are at 0.15 or higher, which isn't very surprising. And there's really no data showing a lot of crashes with people with BAC of 0.05 to 0.08. So that doesn't seem to really do anything other than be a quote-unquote feel-good solution.
Deja, thank you so much for joining us and for this analysis.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That is criminal defense attorney Deja Vishni, who takes on OWI cases. She formerly taught courses in trial advocacy at Marquette University Law School and is the author of the book Suppressing Criminal Evidence. Earlier, we heard from an author of the report, Joe Pietrangelo, who's research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum.
Coming up, a longtime Wisconsin soccer player and coach lost his hands and feet after a near-fatal illness. He shares his story in a new memoir.
I didn't want to face it, but yet I did. Because to me, the first thing that crossed my mind after hearing about the amputations was I'm done playing.
That's next from WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Scott Martin was a rising star in Wisconsin's soccer community, first as a player, then as a college coach. But he was struck by a rare flesh-eating infection that put him in a coma. He spent weeks fighting for his life. Ultimately, doctors had to amputate his hands and parts of both feet to save him.
In the months and years that followed, Martin had to rebuild his body, his mind, and his identity as a coach and athlete, and he had to adapt to living with a disability, from facing discrimination to learning to use special electrically controlled hands.
He chronicles his story in his new book, Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. Martin lives in Stevens Point, where he continues to coach soccer. His memoir is out now. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. Very good to be here.
Well, I want to take your soccer career up to the point where the action in your book starts. Tell us a little bit about your background in soccer that led you to being a coach at UW-Eau Claire.
I had gone up the traditional ranks of first getting into education, and I was teaching social studies and history at West Bend. Had earned some accolades throughout my career coaching at the high school level. Marilyn Scrivseth, who was the athletic director at UW-Eau Claire at the time, got a hold of me. We had a great meeting and asked me to come on board and start the program. So that was really an interesting time to be able to take something from nothing and build it. So our first year, we ended up being nationally ranked, and everything was going on good from there until we got to a little bit of a fork in the road.
Yeah. And again, before that fork in the road, you had also played at UW Oshkosh. And this is before, right, soccer was the thing that kids did. You were at an earlier cutting edge for U.S. soccer in a lot of ways.
Yeah, actually, when I was 16, I was playing for the men's team, and we would be playing against larger clubs in the Midwest at that time. So there's a lot of firsthand learning by getting your butt kicked. So actually, at that time, Rob, a lot of it was educating the public, educating the kids that were growing up. A lot of people, one of my favorite things was trying to explain the offside rule to parents at the time in the mid 70s. So that was a difficult thing, but we knew what we had to do to make this game move forward in the United States.
You mentioned that fork in the road that really changed a lot of, I think, your vision for your future. Talk us through what happened.
That summer after my first year at UW-Eau Claire, like I said, we were nationally ranked. I was heading over to Europe with a group of college players playing three top tournaments over there. I always had opportunities to play, to go in as a guest player. The year before that, I played against the Dutch Olympic team because I knew the coach. So everything was looking great. Nike got a hold of me and said, we've heard some good things. Hey, why don't you come on down and speak at our Midwest camp? 100 of the top high school players in the country. Yeah, you bet. You know, we're going to be there. National players, coaches from across the country. And when I got there, I was feeling okay. But after the first day, we got into a coaches exhibition match. And I actually, Rob, I've never done this before. I had to pull myself out because of fatigue. I had no idea what was going on, but I spent that night either throwing up profusely or sweating like crazy and shivering like crazy in my dorm room, realizing something was wrong. Didn't know where any doctors were outside of Chicago, but my mom was in Janesville, an hour and a half away. So we all know if doctor's not available, you go to mom. She, of course, in her female wisdom, said something's wrong. Get your butt over to the emergency room right away. And that's where things started tumbling in the wrong direction and going back to speaking about that fork in the road.
And ultimately, you end up in a coma. What you wake up and you do not know what has been happening for what weeks, a month, I think, at this point.
A month.
Yeah.
Yeah, a month. I woke up for a doctor. I think he was dancing around the issue and he was soft about it, but I couldn't move because I had lost 40 pounds of muscle through atrophy, being in a coma for a month. That sort of thing happens. And I couldn't speak because I was intubated. There were numerous machines in the room. And then he started going into the spiel about what happened. He said, okay, you had contracted group A strep with necrotizing fasciitis. Okay, I kind of get that. But then when he dropped the bomb of saying the media has been calling it the flesh-eating disease, you know, this was what killed Jim Henson in 1990, creator of the Muppets. Then he mentioned the word amputation. Okay. And that's when I think my brain started shutting down, Rob, to be in all honesty. That's what I did. I skipped past denial, or excuse me, I didn't skip past denial. I held on to denial strong and hard for years to come. I didn't want to face what was going on. All of a sudden, going from a white guy in athletics being successful to all of a sudden now being labeled as disabled. And I started labeling myself as disabled as well.
You find out you've lost your hands. You're never going to be able to walk again like you did. You went through a long process of rehabilitation. In some ways, one blessing, one benefit of your athletic career, and your doctors and rehab people said to us, you had a mindset that lets you get through that rehab process. Tell us a little bit about that.
I had the work set to be able to go into it, but yet I had no clue what was going on. There were 4 months of rehabilitation in a hospital setting that I still had yet to go through. And then it was, now what? And now what? No clue of what was going to happen. Prosthetists that I worked with, you know, on creating items for disabled people, people with amputations, had never worked with a person that was bilateral hand amputee, let alone bilateral foot, partial foot amputee. So I became a quad amputee. How am I going to deal with that? How am I going to deal with that in our society that doesn't fare well with the disabled community as it is?
And this, I think, for a lot of people is a version of a nightmare. Take the thing you love the most in the world, in your case, soccer, and take away your perception of your ability to do it. You do come back and coach soccer, and we'll get into that. But in that moment, and in those weeks, knowing that, hey, you were never going to be able to go out on a soccer field and play like you had before, how did your mind work with that?
I didn't want to face it, mm-hmm. but yet I did. Because to me, the first thing that crossed my mind after hearing about the amputations was I'm done playing. I was still playing at a higher level. We had just won an indoor championship. I was playing out of Minneapolis. And that was really hard. The way I try to describe it to people is this. think of a concert pianist, not saying I was an amazing player or anything, but to me, concert piano, and all of a sudden somebody takes it away. There it goes. You know, my heart, my art was gone now. That's what I found. Very difficult.
We're talking to Scott Martin of Stevens Point. He's the author of the new memoir, Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. It follows his experience as a soccer player and coach, the illness that led to the loss of both of his hands and parts of both feet, and what came next. Scott, you did go back to soccer, to coaching at various levels. You've remained attached to the game since then. What led you to say, hey, I'm not giving up, at least on this coaching part of soccer?
Oh, after the hospital, I mean, like I said, Rob, that I coached for four more years, but I ended up at the college level. I ended up running into the brick wall depression, which is no surprise. And in the book, that's the first thing I had to do when I was writing, be totally open and honest so people could get inside of my head, inside of my emotions on this. So I did, but I also realized that my coaching was becoming less than, my recruiting was becoming less than. We ended up falling out of the national rankings. I ended up resigning because that's what I should have done for the program. And from there, I mean, I ended up getting into a point where I decided to break myself down in order to build myself back up. I had to go through something extremely difficult in order to, I guess, rediscover myself. So that's a different fork in the road, again, that I ended up taking myself down this time. I was under control this time, and that's what I was going to do.
You mentioned depression being a wall. Another wall came from outside of you, people's perceptions of you as somebody who wanted to coach this active game with a disability. I think you overheard somebody after a job interview saying something like, why'd you bring a guy with no hands in to coach, you know, to audition as a soccer coach? The things you saw from potential employers, from players and others, mm-hmm. How did that affect you?
Mm-hmm. I lost some of my belief in society because I had never, you know, again, I went from a white guy coaching the athletics that was successful to now being labeled as disabled. And I found out what that's been like. And it's interesting, Rob, that I've never been, in my mind, on how I view someone as being discriminatory against me or not. I've never found discrimination from a female. It's always come from males. And I'm not a psychologist to get into studying that, but it is intriguing. I think it has a lot to do with male mortality and the fear that what happened to me could happen to them. And I don't think males are capable or are less capable than females of being able to cope with something like that. See, because going back, when I first found out I lost my hands and such, I distanced myself. I didn't want to deal with it, so I get it.
One interesting tell that you come back to repeatedly in the book is, what do people do when they go to shake your hand and they see your hands aren't what they were expecting to see?
Mm-hmm. It's most interesting, Rob, when someone shakes my hand, because it's an automatic thing to not look at the hand. You just meet hands. And if they happen to notice when they're shaking my hand, oftentimes, and again, it's always been males, pull back, not knowing, and I get it. You know, all of a sudden you're it's not a physical hand. It's not skin. It's rubber, the glove that I wear over these. And I've come across that sometimes where they've even, I sense a reaction that they have something over me, that they think less of me and therefore of my team. But that ends up being a positive for me because I use that in my preparation and thoughts as we go into that match. Because teams, players reflect how their coaches are. And therefore, they just gave me some free information. I'm going to use that information. And most of the time, we ended up beating teams like that. It is interesting.
One of my favorite portions of the book, Scott, is you're coaching for a club team. And the staff there looks at you and assigns you the C team, right? Well, these are the kids. We're glad we're making money from their parents. They're not going to go anywhere. How did you rise to that challenge?
Oh, well, there was a 20-year gap between me leaving coaching at the college level. I had an opportunity to become the head coach at Gonzaga. And I ended up going, first of all, in a very different direction. I ended up becoming a parent of five kids, two from Romania, three from Ethiopia. I came back when my youngest was old enough to be able to handle it. And that's what I ran into, another sense of position of discrimination. They didn't look, I don't know if they looked at my resume, they had to, but yet, no, you're not going to coach A team, not the B team. Here's, you know, 12-year-olds, you get the C team. Yeah, like you said, Rob, bring in those checks. But that, to me, spurred me because it's strange how life can be. At this exact same time, I was coming around and returning to who I was. So therefore, working with these kids, they were just lacking confidence. They could play. They were just lacking confidence. So we ended up going on the same journey together. And that's what the second half of the book is all about. And I think that's what a lot of people are glomming onto and calling this a positive story in negative times. It's working with those 12-year-olds and how we both, or all of us, went down that same path for saying to heck with you to the people that thought that they couldn't do something and thought that I couldn't do something.
I'm going to detour a little as a lifelong or a longtime soccer parent watching from the sidelines. I love the way you approach coaching with your players. You talk about giving them the skills and the tools they need to make decisions on the field and know the flow of the game and go where they be. Whereas I've seen coaching that's you be in the spot that fits my scheme, and if you don't, you're in trouble. Why do you – and that seems – your way seems, A, more fun and a better way to develop people. Tell us a little bit about that philosophy.
I don't know why people have gotten – you know, I grew up with football, basketball, baseball as well, and it's all – that's very structured. But the coach, Klaus Kroner, who took me under his wing, again, when I was 16, I learned a lot about the freedom of the game. And I studied Johan Cruyff and what the Dutch were doing and Pep Guardiola with what he did with Barcelona and then with Manchester City. The game itself, Rob, is so free-flowing. For example, I bring a boombox. We play music at our training sessions, not for the players, but for me to try to get them into that flow of the music, because we play jazz, blues, rock, you know, reggae, Motown, even some disco. So there's something free-flowing about it. And I've always had a mantra that has been, my mission is not to teach you, but to put you in a position to learn. It's totally different. But once they get it, once they accept freedom, it's rock solid, and they become better players, and therefore they become a better team. Just because of something so simple, that's the way I look at it. It's simple. This game is free-flowing. Why not let the players flow freely? As long as they have the basic concepts, then they take it where they want to.
And Scott, as we wrap up, what are you hoping people take away from this memoir now that it's out in the world?
I hope they find it thought-provoking. I hope it gets people to talk about the disability community. Heck, we're coming out during the World Cup. Just to stir some conversation. We could all use a positive story. And if it's picked up that way, I'm totally happy with that.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Scott Martin is an award-winning soccer coach, educator, and advocate for the disability community. His new memoir is called Play From Your Heart, A Journey Through Loss, Resilience, and the Beautiful Game. As we heard earlier in the show, and as a lot of you know, communities in Wisconsin are getting hit hard by wildfire smoke.
And if that includes your community, we really want to hear from you, and we can share your stories here on Wisconsin Today and with our news department.
Let us know how you are staying safe and how things look in your neighborhood. If you have pictures you can share, send them our way.
You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, our number, 888-642-0232. And stay safe. Limit your exposure to extreme smoke as much as you're able to. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Mackenzie Crummy, and Beatrice Lawrence.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.